the 20th of February, and we're continuing our interview with Jerry Faust at Tufts. And I wanted to start off, and this kind of goes back with some things you said yesterday and also in the first session, about, you know, your own attitudes and your generation, living through the Vietnam War period, the era, and learning and being involved in chemistry at a professional level, and kind of how did you feel and how do you feel about the role of the chemical companies during the Vietnam period? We talked about, kind of joke yesterday, that, you know, DuPont did make life better through chemistry, but then there was, you know, the time you grew up in was this big problem with Dow Chemical.
Mm-hmm.
And had that ever entered your mind as to what you were doing and maybe that whole generation of issues?
Yeah, I guess, quite frankly, I didn't... I didn't think much about, you know, napalm as being a chemical product for some reason or another until later on. But I was becoming aware of the environmental onslaught that chemical companies were participating in, or not guarding as well as they could have, especially oil refineries. I think I was a little bit more in tune with that because I was, you know, spending a lot of time outside and enjoyed camping and hiking and the like. So I must admit that I never made the connection between some of the real destructive forces that chemical companies developed that was used in wartime at the time of the Vietnam War, when I was kind of beginning to see that, well, not all chemistry is great, because they were polluting beyond their means or beyond their control, and that wasn't so hot. But it obviously didn't affect me to the point that I didn't apply for jobs there. However, when I went to DuPont, now DuPont has a long history of making explosives, and there was a lot of discussion and concern about, they weren't doing it at that time, of course, but they made big money at that for a century, and was that money tainted? Are our jobs, are we saying that was good because we worked there? So that was an issue that was discussed occasionally, you know, more at social gatherings or whatever. And I didn't see any demonstrations or people threatened to quit, you know, because they realized that DuPont made gunpowder and fueled a lot of both sides of the Revolutionary War. So, but it never got beyond that.
Yeah. Okay. And then to move on to things that we did talk about yesterday, and I wanted to ask, what educational opportunities or what opportunities did you have to further your education while you were in the Brown and Goldstein lab? And had you thought at that time to perhaps, you know,
mm-hmm. Well,
do coursework in some formal way?
Well, I never had any formal opportunities for education. I was able to attend a couple of meetings, a couple, and I actually presented at one meeting. But I didn't take any graduate classes or courses anywhere connected with the medical center or other schools around. And as I said, mentioned I think yesterday there, Joe and Mike had always encouraged me to apply to graduate school at Southwestern. And I think I talked a couple of times to the Department of Biochemistry. I knew some people there just to see what the requirements were and what their feeling was about my potential application. And there wasn't a whole lot of enthusiasm from them. So I suspect because I wasn't at the level of the students that they were applying, that they were getting an application in terms of GRE and great GPA, and I'm sure that they would have given me some benefit or some upgrade because of my experience, but it wasn't say, oh yeah, come on, let's go. So I guess just and then I wasn't that gung-ho to get back in the classroom anyway. I mean, I was having a good time in the laboratory, and I still didn't think I needed to have a PhD to continue to have a good time in the laboratory. So I didn't give it a lot of hard thought.
Right. Okay. Well, you had also mentioned that when you moved out, you moved to DuPont, and you were separating from the Brown and Goldstein lab, and you were trying to create a different ground for you. You didn't want to do what the Goldstein and Brown lab was doing. And how did they, what was their feelings? How did they let you separate from, was there any kind, like with graduate students, postdocs, any kind of discussions over what you could take with you? Were they advising you in any way?
No, there were absolutely none. They didn't offer to let me take some projects, and I didn't ask to take some projects. And it, up until the time, or at, through the time that I left, I never went to them and said, "Well, these are what I'm going to, these are the projects I'm going to do. What do you think?" Now, when I went back, I told them what I had been doing. Of course, it wasn't behind their back, because it was something. And then I'd say, "What do you think?" You know.
Right.
So, but I just kind of wanted to get started in those and. And try it out first before I sought their advice. So the answer is that, you know, we never discussed what I was going to do when I left their lab in any form.
Yeah. Okay. And when you left DuPont, how did the separation take place?
Well, I seem to remember that when I left, so at that time, DuPont was becoming more, say, biotech-like, and then therefore more proprietary.
Right.
So I'm, and I seem to remember a discussion with one of their management people who's part of an outgoing an orientation
right.
about what I was going to do when I left, and not wanting to give away anything, I probably was pretty nebulous, because I already knew that, you know, more or less what I was going to do. I just didn't want to give them the opportunity to say, well, no, you can't take that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember the details of the discussion, but I just didn't want to give them any more information than I could. So I think Jim Gaylor, I'm pretty sure that he knew what I was going to do. I probably told him. So I had more or less his approval, but then he always kind of sided with, you know, what our feelings were sympathetic to my feelings. So I don't think he would have stood in the way anyway. But I guess in retrospect, DuPont might have had, as a biotech entity, might have had some interest in some of the stuff that Laura and I have done since. I left behind, I'd created a cell line, this mevalonate transporter cell line, that turns out to be a very valuable reagent for studying isoprenylation as it emerged shortly thereafter. So, you know, we got an enormous amount of requests to get that cell line out. And so I left it with them. I don't know if they ever used it for anything.
Mm-hmm.
But that was potentially something that could be not only profitable, but provide a significant advantage to owners.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't take any other, that was actually, it was a cell line that it was created in Monty Krieger's lab, but it was done kind of jointly because of my idea to select for that cell line. And so it wasn't created at DuPont, and they really didn't have, although it was characterized there, they really didn't, I don't think they have any right to say patent it or whatever.
Mm.
So I guess I didn't think that there was many other discussions about between DuPont and myself when we left.
Mm.
There was a discussion about the fact they wanted to have a blood sample from me.
Why was that?
This kind of off the. So they had decided that they needed to have blood samples from employees at the time they started to work and as well as when they left. That way, if in the future an employee became ill and tried to say that they contracted something that could be measured in the blood, that the company would have, say, before and after, and could say, well, yes, or a court could say, yes, it did occur, say, like a virus in this employee during that period of time and not before or not after. So unfortunately, they hadn't started that policy when I started, so there wasn't any sample on file, baseline. But they wanted to collect one from me at the end. Well, as a scientist, I could see that this was an invalid experiment and put me at a disadvantage, potentially.
Right.
So I refused to give the terminating blood sample, and then they refused to give me my paycheck. So that went, once again, through these management people on the disorientation, I guess, and that required about 2 weeks of discussions.
That's really strange.
It is, isn't it? That's just, sometimes that's kind of exemplifies the level of bureaucracy and paranoia that can occur.
Right, I guess so. So you never had to, did you get your paycheck without having to?
Yep.
And so, like, is that written into employees' contracts?
I think so now.
Wow, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. You know, I say, well, you know, you could have a virus that didn't leave its track in serum. You know, it could be a liver. I mean, you're going to start getting liver biopsies from people before and after.
Okay, well, when you moved on to Tufts then, and you started working with Fred Dice,
mm-hmm.
you had some experience, you know, with mentors and the Goldstein and Brown Lab. And how was working with Dice? And how did you see your relationship with him coming in, you know, with a lot of qualifications,
mm-hmm.
and yet, you know, as still being labeled as a graduate student?
It was a very good relationship, and it really hasn't changed much from the time that the relationship we had as graduate student thesis advisor to colleague and co-member of the faculty. I think he realized or thought that I could do things on my own and that he didn't need to supervise me, and that if I wanted some assistance that hopefully I'd be secure enough that I'd go to him, which I did. And so I worked in his lab and occasionally would bop in to his office and tell him what I'd done or ask his advice on something, and then bop back out and do some more experiments and pass him in the hall and say something. So there weren't regular meetings. You know, it's not much different than it is now, where I just drop by his office occasionally and tell him, because we have a grant to work on the same project, so it's not related to what I did in the lab. So I'd, you know, he'd stop by and see me, and we'd talk about what we've done, go off. So it's really the same relationship. It's not like, although he is a pretty hands-off advisor to begin with, most normal students who do their dissertation research in his lab don't have day-to-day or week-to-week guidance from him. He leaves them on their own until they seek assistance. So I was kind of just part of that same scenario, but maybe at a further extreme.
Well, in terms of shaping your own role as mentor to your students,
mm-hmm.
How have the different mentor, or working with Goldstein and Brown, and then working with Dice, and working at DuPont and these different, affected you in terms of how you have decided to become, you know, play the role as mentor?
Well, I mean, I think I benefited benefited most from having direct interactions with Mike Brown, especially, and then also Joe Goldstein, day to day, daily, early on. And I think that's the best approach. So if a student, when a student or a technician or a postdoc comes into my lab, then, you know, I want to see them every day. Because I think that gets them off to a good start, increases the likelihood that they'll be productive initially, which gives them confidence, and gets the project going off, or increases the likelihood that the project will get started off on a positive note and will get rolling along without a lot of with the minimum amount of frustration. And then as they acquire more skills and more confidence themselves, especially in students, more competence in terms of a technician, then gradually kind of pull back from day-to-day experiment interactions. So that's my philosophy. More time-consuming. Now, and that's the opposite of Paulo's dice. But I also see and saw students that go into his lab that are less experienced, and technicians for that matter, that become discouraged and flounder around. And so I think that's a bad scenario, and I try to avoid that. So, but the downside of it is that it requires a lot more effort on my part, you know, to lead and direct, whereas if you just put somebody on there. So I'm pretty hands-on, especially for the first year or so. And some postdocs don't often like that. But you can usually, if you, at the time you're interviewing postdocs or attracting them, you can weed out, or you can see which ones that might not feel comfortable in that setting, that want to be a little bit more independent. Or ones, but I tell them straight up, you know, this is my philosophy, and it works. I've seen it work. So if you're uncomfortable with that, then let's hear it now. And usually the postdocs are accepted.
And how do you treat the technicians that come into your lab? How do you, in terms of fostering independence and encouraging kind of them to pursue perhaps, you know, more education
mm-hmm.
based on your, you know, given your own
mm-hmm.
history?
Well, obviously I want to see people grow as I grew. And so I've had basically two technicians all the time. Three. There was a lag there, but about two years term. Three. And I've encouraged them to become more independent, but at the same time, I was frank with them in telling them that they have a job to do. And their job is to see that the specific aims of the grant that's paying them are performed. Or if they're not performed, that substitute results at the same level are produced. And they're getting paid for that. Just like I'm getting paid to teach as well as do research, and you're getting paid to do your job. And that's different than being a graduate student or a postdoc, because there it's still part of a training position. Even though they're getting paid dollars, the expectation is that the bottom line is that students get trained and postdocs get additional training so that someday they can now get into a job goal-oriented, money-producing situation, like technicians. So I guess what I'm saying is that encouraging independent research is good because technicians like that, and it gives them a chance to test themselves and to broaden their, or to develop their scientific skills. But at the same time, you know, we have to do experiments and to address specific issues and specific goals. And most of the time, those come from my direction because they're the goals that I've set out in a grant or the aims I've set out. So they can't just go wandering off and do their own research. They have to more or less follow a specific set path that I lay down. And they accept that. Now the problem I run into with two technicians is they're very enthusiastic about pursuing their own ideas and doing some independent experiments. You know, they'll come in on the weekends or occasionally come up with something they showed me that I didn't know they did, and that's okay. But oftentimes that causes them to become a little bit more less conscientious about the money producing project. They because they're trying to do 40 hours worth of work in a 35-hour week because they want to do their other stuff. And I did the same thing. I mean, there's just no question that I had experiments going on the side all the time I was working. Not all the time, but often the times I did in Dallas. And I only showed the ones that turned out to be productive. But because I was doing 70 hours worth of work in a 60-hour week, I'd get kind of sloppy on some of the experiments that Joe and Mike were telling me to do or the ideas. So Anne, she wants to do so many experiments that she sometimes makes mistakes on the ones that are important. But that's a fine line that we have to kind of walk in order to maintain the enthusiasm and the creativity or the potential for creativity in these people, because they have gone on. Well, so Anne's going to go to medical school in September, and then she plans to continue to have some sort of research influence in her career, perhaps as an academic medicine. And before that was Andrea Brown, who's in graduate school at Yale University. So, you know, if I'd been a little bit more hard line and said, all right, you got to stop these after hours experiments and focus on, you know, finishing this project so we can get this grant renewed, then she may not have be where she is now. So it's different than from graduate students, that you can kind of let wander around, especially after they've developed some attitude and skills to demonstrate to you that they are not just grabbing things off the shelf and pouring it in the kitchen sink, so to speak. You know, that they are doing meaningful experiments and asking meaningful questions. But the technician, you know, they're getting paid, and they have to perform functions that justify that pay.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about kind of your work that you were doing for your Pew proposal,
mm-hmm.
The MPA work,
mm-hmm.
and the evolution of that research program a little bit, and then that is not the project that you end up
mm-hmm.
working on with most of your Pew money. So perhaps you can talk about how that evolved into your research program and then what happened to that to
mm-hmm.
make you change directions.
So the proposal I submitted for the Pew Scholar Program involved cloning the mevalonate transporter, which is an activity that appeared in a cell line isolated in Monty Krieger's lab as a result of a selection technique that I devised and told and conveyed to Monty. And prior to the cloning, it was just an activity. In other words, this one CHO cell could take up 20 times more mevalonic acid than its progenitor cell. So obviously it had some sort of transporter that facilitated the uptake of mevalonic acid that was missing in this other cell. So we realized that back when I was at DuPont, And actually, that was one project, the cloning of that transporter to actually confirm that it really is a molecular entity and not just some artifact of mutation or whatever, was a project that I seriously considered for my dissertation. However, the other project was also a serious consideration, and I chose the latter because I guess I was just more enthusiastic about studying this modification on transfer RNA and potentially in proteins. So I kind of put the cloning and identification of the mevalonic transporter on back burner, thinking I'd come back to it, and sure enough, I did. And in the meantime, I'd actually done a few experiments to get some preliminary data that it could be cloned. The most convincing was that the expression of this activity, this increased mevalonate uptake in these MET18B2 cells is what they were called, that's a dominant phenotype. If you fuse these cells to just a normal cell, then the uptake is higher in the fused heterokaryons than it is in the unexpressing progenitor cell or unfused cell. So that means that the trait got carried over, and that sort of observation is consistent with the fact that there's been a mutation in the 18B2 cells that allows for now the gain of function of an activity, which is consistent, once again, with a dominant sort of phenotype. So that makes it easy to clone dominant genes if you've got a selection. So and there's kind of a standard protocol to do it. So that was, in essence, the Pew proposal. Now, what's interesting is that at the time I wrote that proposal, I was visiting Dallas and discussed it with Mike and Joe and said, oh, so I think it's time to clone the mevalonic transport, and I'm writing a proposal to the Pew to do this. This is my strategy. This is the preliminary data I have. And they thought it was great. They thought it was an excellent strategy and it would work. And, of course, at the same time, I asked for a recommendation from them, too. So and they encouraged me to go off and do it. So in the meantime, I got tied up with starting up my lab and didn't really do any more on that proposal until I wasn't planning to do any more on it, start on it, until I heard from the Pew to see if it was funded. And I was doing some other things, finishing up some loose ends and experimentations. And within about a year, in a shorter period of time than that, within about 6 months, I'd heard that the mevalonate transporter had been cloned out of the MET18B2 cells by Brown and Goldstein. So I called them and said, how did you do it? And they said, well, we knew it was a dominant phenotype, and we applied a standard protocol for making a cDNA library from these cells and then sorting and by transfecting pools into recipient cells and assaying for the activity, we could narrow the pools down until we got it. And I said, well, didn't you recognize that as the same strategy that I proposed to you on Saturday afternoon sitting around your table in the office? And both of them said no. So then I went down and visited and asked them more about that, and they said that they never remember that discussion. So now that hurt. It hurt real bad initially, because there has been some people in our profession that have thought that Mike and Joe were not as above table as they should be. And I never felt that way. But hearing this was not something that was reinforcing that thinking. However, I also know that they're both extremely busy and have a lot of projects that people propose to them. and they've got a lot going on in their department, a lot of projects going on. And sometimes, and I know I'm guilty of that too, that you can lose track of where you heard something. And maybe it kind of begins to, not only can you forget who told you something, you might even lose track of the fact that you heard it from somebody else and didn't think it up yourself, because it is a standard sort of technology to do this. So I've kind of accepted the fact that indeed they didn't realize that's what we talked about it, and that they didn't, so they didn't run off and clone this deliberately because after I had told them to do it. But the disturbing thing is, at that time, and it still bothers me, is that I was seeking their advice and talking to them about science, and they weren't paying attention, except for that 30 minutes. So it wasn't a lasting impression on them, which, you know, I was disappointed that we could have a conversation that they didn't remember when it was really important to me. So now, you know, 20 years from now, I may make the same mistake. Well, I hope not, but you know, that was a real disappointment that, you know, like I said, we could have a meaningful scientific conversation that was keenly important for me, and they didn't remember. Not that they went off and did it. I mean, they did it a hell of a lot faster than I would have done it. And the student who did it, it was a graduate student who did it, is a really nice person. And other people who were down there are convinced that she didn't have any idea that I had made that proposal, or that I was even interested in doing it. So, you know, I think it was an honest mistake, but it was a little sore.
Yeah.
So that's why I didn't do it, because it was done by the time I got around to doing it. And it turned out to be a very interesting molecule that's been very valuable, because once you pluck it out of cells, now you can put it in any cell you want and get high rates of the melanin uptake. The utility of it is that emerged at a time when the discovery of isoprenylated proteins, which is a modification on proteins derived specifically from mevalonic acid, that came about. So it was hot. It was important that we study isoprenylated proteins, or it was important that we label cells with tritiated mevalonic acid, and look at them at its incorporation into things like RAS and other GTP binding proteins, really key partners in signal transduction. And the problem was that cells don't take up mevalonic acid very well, and mevalonate is very expensive. So you had to spend a lot of money to do an experiment. So if you had this cell line, that means you either spent 1/20th the cost for the tritiated mevalonate, or you waited 1/20th the time to get an autorad, which either decreased cost or increased time, whatever you wanted to do, and push things forward really quickly in studying these prenylated proteins. So, and then that's what they used it for. They got into studying prenylated proteins pretty heavily for a while. I'm not sure that they're studying them so much anymore, but they realized this was an important tool that would not so much save them money, but speed their turnaround time. All right, so that's why I didn't do mevalonate transporter.
Well, do you still seek their advice now?
No.
Have you changed your relationship?
After that, I have never talked with them about science. And it's not because I don't trust them, or I think that they will forget, well, or that they would, you know, go off and do something I said. I mean, they don't have to do that. That's the other reason I didn't think they did it deliberately, because they don't have to do that. They can do other things much worse. But I guess just over time, when I go to Texas to visit my mother or brother, I just stop going to the medical school. and was getting advice elsewhere and was content with that. You know, as I said, I think it really hurt me that, you know, that we could talk and it just didn't last in their minds any longer than 10 minutes or 10 days, whatever it took to conceive this other idea. So, not that I don't think they could certainly provide me with expert advice and meaningful interpretations. And I guess I'm probably the sufferer because we don't interact on a scientific level. But I mean, you got to break away sometime. You don't have to. I mean, that's stupid. That's wrong. I mean, there's lots of... Monty Krieger still has active discussions with them. His in-laws live in Dallas. So he goes down there quite often and visits. And you know, I guess it was just a combination of that incident and not going as often and doing other things. What have you.
Did you talk to Monty Krieger about this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was actually the person that told me that they were doing it at the time they were doing it. Because I had sought Monty's advice on, once again, and counsel on this cloning strategy, and he knew that it was around. So I guess he learned about it from one of his trips to Dallas, and when he came back to Boston, he called me on the phone and says, "Oh, you know that they're doing this?" And I says, "No." And he said, "Well, you know, I know that you proposed to do this. How is it that they're doing it?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And so we began to put dates together, and it happened just about the time after I had been there. So he says, "Well, that's unfortunate." I said, "Yes, it is." Some other people have asked me about that, too. Those mostly people who fell into the category of not thinking as highly of Joe and Mike as others have, looking for the opportunity to substantiate that feeling, you know, that negative feeling about them. But I never, you know, I've always said it was unrelated. People make mistakes. Come on, and people don't listen. I mean, I don't listen. I have a problem all the time. Laura's always telling me, "Well, don't you remember? You know, that we had, somebody said this or that or the other." So it's easy to see how that kind of happens. But you know, it has a lot of impact when it's done from their position. Mm-hmm. You know, we can blow off the fact that I didn't credit a student with an idea that I forgot. But when you're at that level in our profession, you really got to be careful, I think.
Did they ever express any regret?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They said they were sorry that you know, I was upset and I felt that way. They wouldn't have done it if they would have remembered it. And they were sincere.
Well, how do you deal with the disappointments and the frustrations? You know, one, when in the natural course of, you know, the competitive world that you get scooped.
Mm-hmm.
But also, on the second, is that you aren't playing on a level playing field and that there is fraud and misconduct in science and, you know, is there any accountability? So how do you deal with these kind of periods when things aren't going right?
Well, I don't think I've experienced much of that. I don't think I've never been scooped. I think that could be disappointing, but it's usually that if two laboratories are pursuing a common goal, our discovery, and one of them elucidates it in front of the other, it's because, you know, they worked harder, they may be better had better resources or more money. Their people were better skilled. So those are all good reasons. It's not because they broke into the other laboratory and read the notebooks of their competitors or all. So it's hard. You can just say, well, okay, you lost to the best team, so to speak. Tough luck. Let's go on. In terms of, I don't think I've ever encountered, not knowingly encountered any fraud or unprofessional that would lead to some disappointments. Most of the disappointments come about just from our own inadequacies. And even at the level of our disappointments in getting, say, funding, become disappointed at a study section for not giving a high enough score. Well, after the initial frustration and disappointment, you can usually point to the fact that maybe you weren't forceful enough in the proposal or creative enough or clear enough to point to the important issues that you were going to do and why it was important to really focus the attention of the reader on what you had done and why and how that this was good preliminary data, and what you were proposing to do were really essential experiments that were unequivocally going to answer the question yes or no without maybe. And that the results that came, either yes or no, were important to science and would lead to more production. So by just writing the right grant is really so important. It's not so much the data that goes into it or the specific aims. Lots of times it's just presenting it. And those are usually our faults in not in composition or stating the cases. So, but as I said, the disappointments, I guess, are just along the lines of our own inadequacies, whether we have to kind of repeat experiments because we botched them up, or we don't have the proper reagents, or we overinterpreted the data, we took the wrong turn at a crossroads. So those kind of disappointments, I think, are once again our own fault, and a little bit more easy to accept those due to our own doing. At the same time, when we're successful, and then we know that the credit goes to us, and not to the fact that we, got a hot tip from somebody else and didn't really pursue it on our own level or whatever. We had for a long time, so when Laura and I started working on Niemann-Pick C, which is this other lysosomal storage disease, and we realized that it was a defect in cholesterol transport in cells, then there was only one other group in the world who was working on Niemann-Pick C, and this was a group headed by Peter Pinchiff at the NIH. And I guess it was about this, and they had published pretty extensively on it. In fact, I read all their papers and came to this, and they were postulating that it was a defect in regulation, and in just that they didn't see the connection between transport and regulation. So it was, I just kind of extended that to say, well, the reason it's a defect in regulation is that they don't move the cholesterol around to get to the regulatory sites. So it's kind of, somebody could argue, well, that's just a fine tuning of their theory, but it still was. It's instrumental in the thought process of how one goes about picking it apart. So I think they arrived at that about the same time we did. But, we published it first with our first publication, whereas they had like six others and then finally came to the same conclusion in the seventh one. But right away that kind of set set up a competition and a little bit of animosity. Not so much, well, I guess it was equal on my part and Laura's and Peter's, but other people would tell us that we weren't thought of very highly by the people in Washington. And interestingly, so for the first about, after we put out a couple of papers that more or less said the same thing, to substantiate the idea that it was transport and not just a specific regulatory event, our papers would appear in the bibliographies of their papers. And for about three papers in a row, I think, there was always some mistake in the citation.
Let me flip this over.
Mm-hmm.